Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Steven Siegel, and today we'll be joined by Heyi Chu, who is the author of The Life of Permafrost, A History of Frozen Earth in Russian and Soviet Science, published by University of Toronto Press in 2021. Welcome, Heyi, and thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Steven.
So here we have Dr. Chu, who is an associate professor of history at Pomona College, where she teaches courses in modern European history. A historian of Russia and the Soviet Union, she received her PhD from Princeton University. Her research aims to understand the environment and environmental change through the history of science and technology. This focus has led her to explore such topics as the history of the earth sciences, science policy, the politics of expertise, and the transnational circulation of ideas. Heyi has held fellowships at the Davis Center for Russian and Eurasian Studies and the Rachel Carson Center for Environment and Society. And her work has appeared in Environmental History and Environment and History. So we're really happy to be able to cross-post this on our New Books channels, Russian and Eurasian Studies, Environmental Studies, as well as History and Geography. So I want to start, Dr. Chu, simply with a question about what brought you to this topic, the life of permafrost. How did you become interested in researching the book?
Yeah, so I came to the topic via a pretty meandering path. I went to grad school for Russian history, and I was initially, you know, interested in the kind of in-betweenness of the Russian Empire and the Soviet Union, kind of straddling the Eurasian continent. I was initially interested in researching, you know, the economic development of Eastern Siberia, because I felt that, you know, there wasn't much that was really known about it. And it seemed to me that there were really interesting particularities of that region that I didn't know about. So I got started researching the history of the construction of this railroad called the Baikal-Amur Mainline. And as I was kind of digging into the sources, the topic that kept coming up a subject that kept coming up in the sources was this phenomenon, which in the Russian sources is called Vechna Merzlota and is later called permafrost. So and I was very curious about what this was. I was like, Vechna Merzlota, what a curious, you know, expression. You know, Vechna means eternal, and Merzlota, well, it's a little bit ambiguous what that means, but, you know, one way of understanding is like eternal frozen earth. And so I was very curious about what it was and start kind of digging into the meaning of this concept and how people understood this phenomenon, and discovered that there were all these interesting debates about what it was, why we needed to study it, how it was related to the surrounding environment, and kind of just fell down that rabbit hole. And along the way, I, you know, became aware and interested in these subfields of history, you know, environmental history, the history of science, like kind of subfields that I hadn't really known about as an undergrad and became very curious about as I started to, you know, want to learn more about this phenomenon of frozen earth. So it was a bit of a kind of meandering path. And yeah, I eventually just fell down this rabbit hole and you know, eventually, I guess, wrote a book about it.
So let's talk about permafrost and permafrostology and the history of science and technology studies. How do you understand the study of permafrost historically? How do you understand its change over time?
Right. So, I wanted to treat permafrost not, you know, I didn't want to take it for granted as something that was, you know, timeless, universal, natural, just this neutral object of the environment. I wanted to look at the history of, you know, different understandings that people had about frozen earth and even contested understandings about frozen earth and see how they changed over time. And so the story begins, well, a little bit in the 18th century, but mostly in the 19th century, when European naturalists start to become interested in this phenomenon. And I kind of take it through the early Cold War, when, you know, frozen earth acquired almost geopolitical significance because there was a need to, you know, build military infrastructure in, you know, the Arctic regions. So over the course of this, you know, 100 years or so, 120 years, there were different understandings of frozen earth, and sometimes they clashed with each other, and scientists had debates, sometimes very, very bitter debates about, you know, whether what this phenomenon was. You know, was it earth or was it ice? Was it a physical structure? Was it an aggregate structure? Or was it really more of a condition or a process or a space or an envelope? And there was a multiplicity of understandings of frozen earth. And that's part of what I am focusing on in this book. Yeah.
Right. Thank you. And so how did you arrange your chapters in the book? How did you choose your chapters on mapping, building, defining, adapting, translating, and resurrecting? I'm very curious about that, the arrangement and organization of your chapters.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I sort of constructed this metaphor. You know, the title of the book is The Life of Permafrost, and I sort of imagined permafrost as kind of moving through different phases, like an insect, you know, like a butterfly, right? So there's like an egg stage, and then the larval phase, and then a pupal phase, and an adult phase, and these chapters focus on different sort of phases in the life of permafrost, and in each of these phases, you know, permafrost, well, what we know today as permafrost was known by different names, you know, so in the 19th century, in the kind of the egg phase, you know, it was a German expressions, you know, Boden ice or ice Boden. And then in the next stage, in the kind of larval stage, it got these kind of Russian names like Mirzlata. And then in the kind of, you know, pupil stage, it started kind of crystallizing a little bit as Viechnaya Mirzlata during the Soviet Union in the 1920s and 30s. And then in the adult phase, it became permafrost when, you know, American scientists and engineers translated these Russian expressions into English. And so the chapters, you know, both center on different scientific practices, you know, as you were saying, mapping, building, defining, adapting, and translating, but it's also focusing on different phases in the so-called life of permafrost. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And where did your research take you exactly? Where did you end up finding sources and doing research, and in particular in Russia? And how did you get there, and what were you looking for?
In terms of my sources, yes. So I was looking a lot at both published and unpublished writings by scientists. So, you know, this could be, you know, expedition reports. They could be letters, correspondence between scientists, articles from scientific journals, works of popular science, and also, you know, documents from like scientific institutions, like, you know, the Institute for Frozen Earth Science in the Soviet Union. And so I did a lot of work in the archive of the Russian Academy of Sciences in Moscow. that was a really great repository because they had the documents of the Institute for Frozen Earth Science. And then I also did quite a bit of work in the Russian State Archive of the Economy, because part of the papers of that institute, you know, back when it was known as a commission and then a committee, it was in the kind of state archive. So those are the kind of two main archives for digging into the evolution of this institute in the Soviet Union. And then I also did some work at the local studies museum in Saransk, which is, you know, kind of this more provincial town. But that's where one of the main characters of the book, Mikhail Sumgin, you know, his papers were located in the museum there. And so I, you know, he's from that region. And so I did some work there. And then I also spent some time in Yakutsk, which is where the Melnikov Permafrost Institute is located. And they had a nice library that I could use to kind of access some more, you know, rare published sources on frozen earth. Yeah.
I have to start, Peiyi, because I'm so curious about maps with your first chapter on mapping. So did you find a lot of maps of frozen earth? I know there's some very beautiful maps that you include, some by Germans and some by Poles. So how could you describe those? Where did you find them, and what are they like descriptively?
So if I hear you correctly, you're asking about the maps in chapter one?
Yes. Yeah, so Carl Ernst von Baer and some of the others, right?
Yeah, Leonard Yachevsky. Yes. Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So yeah, let's see. How did I come across? I mean, Carl Ernst von Baer's map I first encountered in the published work of this Estonian geographer, Erki Tammiksaar, who's been a wonderful resource, and he's kind of an expert on Baer. And Tammiksaar wrote a dissertation focusing on the geographical thought of Carl Ernst von Baer, and he talked about how, you know, Baer produced the first map of frozen earth. And so I became curious about this map. On the other hand, I think in the course of my research, I also came across this other map by Leonard Yachevsky, who is a Polish-Russian geologist in the 19th century. And I was struck by how different these maps looked from each other. Like Carl Ernst von Baer's map, it's kind of got layers, it's got shading. And Yachevsky's map is just like lines, like it kind of, you know, and I was like, wow, how is it that this phenomenon is represented in such different ways? And in order to understand, you know, why they represented it so differently, I had to dig into what they understood frozen earth to be. And, you know, Baer, he kind of, you know, promoted these two expressions to kind of, you know, he named frozen earth with two expressions. One was Boden ice and the other was ice Boden. And they actually had very distinct meanings for him. You know, Boden ice referred to the substance of ice, and he was interested in the substance of ice in the ground. But ice Boden referred to more of a space. It wasn't like an actual substance, but it was like a realm of the earth where, you know, Boden ice could be found in its kind of perpetual form, you know, lasting for many years. And so, Baer, and so the different layers on Baer's map represent, you know, Boden ice and ice Boden, like these two different concepts that he was putting forth. But Yachevsky's map, Yachevsky's map is based on the ideas of Alexander von Middendorf, you know, who was a protege of Baer's, but didn't actually have the same idea of frozen earth as Baer. You know, Middendorf really fixated on this idea of ice Boden, and he conceived of frozen earth as the substance of the earth itself, you know, the soil, the ground, the rock. And moreover, he defined it on the basis of temperature, like with, you know, that, you know, ground that has a negative temperature. And so, you know, Yachevsky took that idea and said, okay, if it's ground on the basis of temperature, then we can take these kind of isotherms and we can kind of take what we know about levels of precipitation and snow and kind of, you know, trace the outlines of this structure, this physical aggregate structure that known as frozen earth, you know, ice Bowden. And so, you know, there are really kind of distinct approaches to understanding frozen earth. Baer, who's interested in kind of the substance of ice and interested in kind of this envelope or space, and then Middendorf and then Yachevsky kind of conceiving it more as actual soil or rock or, you know, the ground, the earth. Yeah.
If you could conceptualize the shift in this epistemology and ontology in the history of science and permafrost, What happens among these men of science in the late Tsarist period?
Uh-huh. So if I heard you correctly, so we've been talking about Baer and Middendorf, and they were kind of really interested in kind of natural history and, questions of natural history. But in the late 19th century and early 20th century, another motivation for studying frozen earth emerged, which was, you know, engineering, construction, and, the Trans-Siberian Railroad, you know, built in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, it runs through regions with frozen earth. And frozen earth turned out to pose all sorts of challenges for construction. You know, road beds would kind of deform, railroad depots, buildings would kind of start to sink, when the earth thawed beneath it. And so there was this new motivation for studying frozen earth. And this motivation only intensified from the late imperial to the Soviet period, because the Soviets, you know, had a very ambitious program for, you know, industrializing, modernizing, quote unquote, Siberia. So one of the main characters of the book, Mikhail Sumgin, he actually got his start studying frozen earth in this context, you know, in the context of the construction of the Siberian Railroad, in the context of, you know, the 5-year plans in the Soviet Union. So, and he was a very interesting character too. I mean, he only wound up in Siberia because, you know, he had been a revolutionary. He had been a part of the Socialist Revolutionary Party and, you know, got kicked out of St. Petersburg University for participating in protests and was, like, you know, exiled multiple times and ended up in Siberia. And then got roped into the work of the Tsarist Resettlement Administration, which was all about studying the soil in order to evaluate it for, you know, development, you know, agriculture, construction, things like that. And so he was very immersed in this environment, and that imperative, that engineering imperative, I argue, shaped his particular conception of frozen earth that is ours today. You know, this idea that it's ground with a negative temperature that lasts for 2 years or more. I mean, it's a very peculiar definition. It builds a little bit on Middendorf, of course, but, you know, there's also, you know, he kind of adds the kind of 2 years idea, which, you know, becomes a bit controversial because people are like, oh, Vietchna, eternal, means like 2 years. That's very strange. And then he was also the one who promoted Vietchna Mrzlota specifically as the term, you know, because there were other ways of perhaps talking about it.
But
he kind of thought it was very poetic, you know, it was of the people. And, you know, this also reflects a little bit his personal background, his political background, you know, as a populist.
Right. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about Sumgin and his rivals. So you have this great chapter about Mikhail Sumgin and Parkhomenko, who seems to be his antagonist. And they seem to have very different philosophical ideas as well as political approaches. I mean, it seems so fundamental in their debates and in their differences through the 1920s and 1930s. So could you introduce our listeners to Sumgin and maybe Parkhomenko and others as you see fit? I know that Sumgin was a social revolutionary, right? But who were these men, and what were their clashes and what were their differences?
Yeah. So so Sumgin, I mean, he's known today as kind of like, you know, the founder of permafrost science. And, you know, I mentioned that our conception of permafrost today really comes from him, and the definition that he kind of put forth in his monograph that was published in 1927, and that he kind of promulgated through Soviet, you know, popular science publications and textbooks and all that. But his was not the only conception of frozen Earth. You know, as we were just talking about, it's a very peculiar definition. You know, Pakhomenko was another Soviet scientist. He was not a revolutionary, but he at some point ended up in the Irkutsk area and was doing kind of surveying work in the 1920s and got interested in this phenomenon as well. And Pakhomenko was trained as a geographer, and he was really interested in complexes, you know, not looking at how the different elements of a geographical region were related to each other and connected to each other. And he really approached frozen Earth, or, you know, as well, in two ways. Like, one, this word Mirzlata, he understood it not as a substance or a material object, but rather as a process of freezing. And the actual, you know, substance of frozen Earth, he called cryophilic rocks, which were rocks that, you know, contain cryophilic minerals, meaning like minerals that, you know, that could freeze. And so he was really frustrated with Sumgin's definitions, which he thought made no sense. This idea of ground, he thought, obscured the particular material composition of this substance. You know, it was about rock. It was about cryophilic minerals. It wasn't just about ground. Right? Ground is this very all-encompassing, like almost like engineering concept. And Pakhomenko thought, you know, it was very inadequate to describing this phenomenon. Mm-hmm. And also temperature, right? Defining frozen Earth on the basis of temperature, you know, having a negative temperature to Pakhomenko didn't make sense, because he's like, well, you know, water in nature does not freeze at 0 degrees because of all the impurities. And so what we really need to look at is the phase change and the kind of physical material transformation, the hardening of this substance, rather than like some arbitrary thing like a negative temperature. And then in terms of, you know, 2 years, well, he just thought that was very like, it didn't, especially when paired with this concept of Vyeshna, really didn't make a lot of sense to him. You know, to him, you know, there was a time when frozen Earth did not exist, and there's a time when it did, and it may disappear. I mean, there's nothing particularly eternal about it. And so their debates, you know, they were intellectual debates, but they were also, you know, personal animosities. I mean, Sumgin, he was able to kind of have this position in the Academy of Sciences. And this was a time when the Academy of Sciences, you know, under kind of Soviet patronage, was really expanding and becoming really important organization for science. And so Sumgin kind of, you know, was able to become the deputy director of this commission, then which turned into a committee, which turned into an institute. And then Pakhomenko wasn't really in this circle as much. And moreover, you know, you brought up the idea of epistemological differences. I mean, so at this time, you know, Soviet science, it had to kind of wrestle with the ideology of the state at the time, you know, Marxism-Leninism, you know, dialectical materialism. And both Sumgin and Pakhomenko were, you know, engaging with dialectical materialism, not simply as an ideology, but also as an epistemology, but differently. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Pakhomenko was really interested in this idea of, you know, the dialectic, the exchange and opposition of different forces kind of on a molecular level, you know, and how frozen Earth engages in interactions with its environment. And Sumgin kind of took this idea of theory and practice, you know, the idea in the Soviet Union that, you know, science should have kind of practical uses and serve the state and the economy and the military. And so, you know, his engineering kind of focused approach of frozen Earth really fit that aspect of dialectical materialism, whereas Pakhomenko was taking it more seriously as an epistemology, like how do we actually apply dialectical materialism to understanding the formation and the evolution of frozen Earth.
Yeah.
And so they had very different understandings of what dialectical materialism means and how you can apply it to science.
Right.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Could you, and I'm very curious, Peiyi, to ask you about your understanding of institutions, because when historians tend to think about science wars, they think following the work of Ethan Pollack and others about the period of high Stalinism. But from your book, one thing that I learned that seems so important is the marginalization of scientists from institutions. I mean, there seems to be a kind of moment in time in the NEP period, but maybe even into the 1930s, where there are some central institutions with big personalities, and then there are other institutions where people like Parkhomenko get marginalized. And I wonder if you could give our audience and the readers of your book a bigger understanding of this. Which institutions do you see with this study of permafrost, not only as an eternal thing, which do you see are central and which are sort of marginal into the marginalized subdisciplines of the sciences here, geology and climatology and so forth? I hope I'm clear with my question. It's really a question about institutions and these individuals, which are central and which are marginal.
Mm-hmm. If I kind of understand correctly, well, I guess I really focus on, I mean, as I was mentioning before, the Academy of Science, I mean, you know, Alexander Vucinich called it an empire of knowledge, right? And he really focused on the Academy of Sciences in the Soviet period. And so, you know, I mean, sometimes this could be even as mundane as where are the meetings being held when they have terminology debates, you know, like,
that's it. Like, that's what I was thinking. Yes.
Yeah. So like, you know, if the Academy of Sciences is in Leningrad and, you know, Parkhomenko is working for a state agency in Moscow and they're having this big debate about terminology in Leningrad, and like Parkhomenko finds out a bit late and can't get like tickets on a train to go. I mean, you know, he's just kind of out there. And so, yeah, I mean, yeah, it comes down to sometimes these very mundane things. And mm-hmm. yeah, the difference even, you know, between, you know, center versus being a little bit more marginalized. Yeah.
Right. So what happens then through the Stalin period as the first five-year plan is embraced? How does that change permafrostology and permafrost studies? Is there a shift mm-hmm. as you find it in the Marxism-Leninism of the 20s to the 30s in some of these institutes? And as you say, in the epistemological understanding of permafrost, what happens to these men of applied science?
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, they get requests from all these state agencies that are doing construction to, like, you know, what do we do? What recommendations can you make for construction so that, you know, our roadbeds and factories and buildings do not sink and deform? And there are all these, you know, requests being made of frozen earth scientists to participate in various construction projects, and development projects in, you know, along the Baikal-Amur main line, for example, also in the city of Yakutsk with the kind of building up of, you know, these cities, subarctic and arctic cities. So they're very much immersed in the, you know, the so-called, you know, the conquest of nature, the struggle with nature. And at the same time, you know, they're trying to communicate the importance of their work to, you know, Soviet citizens more generally, to the state, so that they can have funding for their work. And I argue that this period, I mean, the cultural context of this time, you know, when the idea of the struggle with nature is so prominent in Soviet propaganda, that this also shapes Frozen Earth, I mean, understandings of Frozen Earth, encourages people to see it as a physical object, a physical obstacle to be conquered, rather than something more nebulous like a condition or a process or, you know, an envelope that you can't really visualize and struggle against. And it's also at this time that, you know, Vyechnaya Mrzlota, this particular expression, eternal frozen earth, so to speak, really becomes popularized. And
yes, yes, and, I see that.
And it and it's really interesting because Vyechnaya, you know, is this idea of you know, eternal. It's like nature as static, as as unchanging. Whereas, you know, Soviet construction was about moving forward, and it was an interesting contrast, you know, kind of conquering nature, struggling against nature, and also struggling against natural time, you know, in order to accelerate development in, you know, to kind of toward communism, right? And so the expression Vyechnaya Mrzlota has a particular cultural resonance as well at this time.
Right. Yeah. And how does this travel to the United States and really to North America in a Cold War context, and maybe even before the Second World War, the Great Patriotic War is over? You have this in your later chapters, which are so fascinating to you, because you mention again and again about the inexactness of the translation of the definition of permafrost from a Russian and Soviet context into the American one. So this is really a question for you about the moment forward from 1943 and who becomes involved in these American-Soviet exchanges and American-Soviet science right. society.
Yeah. So so the person who coins permafrost is a person named Simon Mueller, who was a, you know, Russian-born emigre to the United States. And he was a geologist. He worked at Stanford University. And, you know, his knowledge of Russian became really important during the Second World War as the United States was building, you know, airfields in Alaska, which later, you know, became involved in doing some of the Lend-Lease exchanges with the Soviet Union. So there was all of a sudden this imperative to build infrastructure on frozen earth in Alaska. And, you know, Simon Mueller, I mean, it became known to the, you know, the USGS that was involved in this work that the Soviets had written a lot about it. A lot of it, the literature was in Russian, and the Russians had been tackling some of these problems in the 1930s. And so Simon Mueller was hired to translate and to synthesize some of that Russian language literature. And so he created, or he published, well, it was initially more like a kind of classified publication, Permafrost and permanently permafrost or permanently frozen ground and related engineering problems. And so he, you know, cited the work of Sumgin and other Soviet scientists, and he coined the expression permafrost (parentheses or permanently frozen ground) on the basis of Sumgin's term Vyechnaya Mrzlota. And he took the same definition, ground with a negative temperature that, you know, sustains negative temperature for 2 years or more. So he just, you know, adopted it because it was kind of in the literature, and he maybe wasn't aware of all the debates that have been going on with Parhomenko and everything like that. It was, you know, because by this time Sumgin's conception had been more widely propagated. So Simon Mueller just kind of took this, the definition, and kind of coined this expression based on a translation of the Russian. But this also sparked, you know, disagreement in the U.S. You know, there were geologists in the U.S., soil scientists. I mean, I talk about this soil scientist named Kirk Bryan, who thought, you know, permafrost, like that doesn't make any sense. It's not about frost. It's about the soil. And, you know, it doesn't capture the dynamic nature of freezing earth. He kind of advanced, that is Kirk Bryan, advanced a whole different set of terms like pergelisol, that try to capture the process of freezing and the substance itself, as opposed to this, you know, the aggregate structure, ground, and like temperature and things like that. So, you know, once again, in the U.S., we see this debate flare up about what is this phenomenon? What do we call it? What is it that interests us about it? But because of the kind of, you know, imperative of the time, which was engineering, construction, you know, just like in the Soviet Union in the 1930s, now it's the U.S. in the 1940s. And what's most important is kind of, you know, stable structures, being able to build. And the word permafrost actually gets quickly taken up by certain institutions like the Snow, Ice, and Permafrost Research Establishment, established by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. And so the word, you know, kind of gets taken up very quickly. And without a whole lot of, you know, interest or debate about the, you know, the nitty gritty of like terminology and definitions. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's go forward from the 1950s and maybe the new sciences, things like geocryologia, right? Geocryology.
Yeah. So this is really interesting too. I mean, so you mentioned earlier, you know, Ethan Pollack's work on the great discussions, you know, that happened in the late 1940s in the context of a bit of a hardening of the Cold War and this renewed pressure for scientists to demonstrate their patriotism and their, you know, their kind of ideological rigor. And so there were these great discussions in various fields at the time. I mean, most famously, of course, in biology with Lysenko, but there were also a lot of discussions taking place, you know, in lots of different scientific disciplines at this time, you know, inspired a bit by these, or pressured a bit by these kind of by the political atmosphere of the time. So in the Institute of Frozen Earth Science too, there were debates, like, you know, does it live up to the rigor, you know, of dialectical materialism? Does it support the kind of goals of the state? And in the course of these discussions, people start to bring up again, once again, like the flaws in the conception of frozen earth that Sumgin had put forth, and kind of maybe returning to ideas about, you know, more of a kind of systems thinking approach, thinking about exchanges of heat and minerals with, you know, between different parts of the environment, and instead of, you know, the study of frozen earth, it's about the study of the cryolitha zone, right? Which is an envelope of the earth where you'll find the freezing of rock. And so it's a little bit hearkening back to Parhomenko, but they didn't really, like Shvetsov, who is the new, I guess, up and coming scientist who was advancing this view. He didn't explicitly acknowledge Parhomenko. I mean, he drew on, you know, this broader tradition of systems thinking in Russian and Soviet science with folks like Vernadsky, Grigoriev. And so he kind of drew the inspiration from them. I mean, so there were all these, you know, the institute at this time was riven by these personal animosities, like intellectual debates, you know, some people wanting to defend Sumgin's legacy and you know, Sumgin as the founder of frozen earth science, who had laid so much of the foundations of the field. And then this kind of younger generation led by Shvetsov, who's saying, no, we really have to rethink what we mean when we talk about frozen earth. We got to think about it more in terms of this, you know, exchanges of heat and minerals. And so, and he called it geocryology. Yeah. And it was interesting too, like, you know, geocryology or geocryology in Russian, which, you know, is really from Greek roots. And so in English, we can call it geocryology. That was part of, you know, renaming the field, renaming the discipline was part of this idea of putting it on a more kind of rigorous theoretical foundations. But at the time, it might be seen as a little bit anti-patriotic, right? You're taking this, you're kind of adopting foreign words instead of, you know, good Russian words like Mirzlata and Mirzlatovyedenie, which was like the science of Mirzlata. And so you see the way kind of the political environment of the time sort of
and I have to ask you about the climate change question that you bring up in your book, because it strikes me as so important. As you mentioned, the attention to metaphors, this is one thing I absolutely love about your book, you know, because you trace it back to the life cycle, as we talked about earlier, the egg, larva, pupil, and butterfly stage. And then there's almost, as it seems, a laziness maybe about the time bomb metaphor, and especially concerning climate change, but in a larger question about global warming and the emitting of methane gas. Could you talk about that and why there seems to be such a fixation in the Anthropocene, another term, but why the time bomb metaphor? It seems to even have been picked up by Greenpeace, and certainly it exists in the 21st century. So what is it, and how do you understand it in the context of permafrost?
Well, I mean, I think the concern is that, you know, there's all this kind of carbon locked in frozen earth. And, you know, with global warming, as, you know, this frozen earth thaws, there's the concern that this carbon will be released, you know, either as carbon dioxide or as methane, and even more alarmingly as methane, because methane, you know, traps even more heat than carbon dioxide, even though it doesn't last as long in the atmosphere. And so, you know, the concern that the thawing of frozen earth will lead to kind of a catastrophic sudden release of methane is something that, you know, worries people, certainly worries people. And so it kind of gave rise to these metaphors, you know, of time bomb, Arctic methane monster, and these mm-hmm. kinds of very scary and threatening type of
spider, right? Of Donna Haraway as well, and, right? And others. Go ahead.
And so on the one hand, I mean, I understand, you know, it's the hope is that if we kind of communicate the severity of the problem, you know, maybe people will take it seriously. We can actually take action to mitigate global warming. But on the other hand, when I hear things like time bomb or methane monster, you know, this idea that it's hostile, it's like nature that's hostile or scary, I kind of wonder whether that's really the most productive way mm-hmm. to go about thinking about global warming, you know, that it's not about this external force of nature that's threatening humanity. It's about humanity itself and what we're doing and the choices that we're making. And can we kind of learn to care and value the environment instead of thinking of it as something to be conquered mm-hmm. or mastered or saved? And so that was, you know, when I hear things like time bomb and conquer and mastering and saving, I mean, I think a lot about Soviet propaganda during the 1930s, which is also about struggle with nature and conquer. And to me, that may not be the approach that will actually, maybe the approach that we actually need when it comes to addressing global warming. I think it's more about caring, about understanding our connections with the rest of nature and the exchanges that take place between human and non-human nature, instead of about conquering or saving.
It seems very androcentric to begin with, right? And I guess that's kind of my big last question for you in asking about the takeaway points for your book and the kind of research that you would like to see in the history of science and technology and mm-hmm. let's say in STS. So, I mean, you mentioned the systems thinking approach. I think that's incredibly important and some of the lost debates about definitions, what do you think would be the role for future historians and historians like you in contributing to the debates about climate change and permafrost?
Well, if I heard you correctly, it's about the takeaways of the book. I guess I can think of three. I mean, one is this idea of pluralism in understandings of frozen earth, like, you know, seeing it as an aggregate structure that is disappearing or that will, you know, cause harm to humans is not the only way of thinking about it. There's also a way approaching it as like a condition, a process, an envelope, a space that's very intimately connected with the rest of the planet. And you know, it's not necessarily about preserving this structure at all costs, you know, even through engineering that may actually, you know, exacerbate global warming, but thinking more in terms of the Earth as a whole, and making room for these other ways of thinking and maybe resurrecting some of these other ways of thinking, like Bowden ice or Mersletta as a process, or, you know, the cryolithozone and geocryology, instead of thinking it as, you know, permafrost, either something to be saved or conquered or that is disappearing. And then secondly, I guess in the book, I wanted to show the different influences that politics can have on science. And it's a multifaceted sort of thing, because it's not simply, you know, in the case of my book, it wasn't just that the Soviet state, party state pressured scientists to, you know, to carry out engineering and construction in Siberia. There are also ways in which, you know, party ideology, Marxism-Leninism, dialectical materialism, inspired debate and discussions and new ways of thinking about frozen earth. So it's a very complicated relationship. It's not simply an oppressive one. It can be also a generative one. And then finally, I would say the idea that language matters. the metaphors that we use matter. The terms, scientific terms, matter. They accrue different meanings over time. They are shaped by society and culture, and they in turn shape society and culture. And that paying attention to language is also important when talking about
and nomenclature debates are still obviously going on, right? Because you participated in a lot of these scientific debates and went to their conferences almost like a fly on the wall, right? In certain ways. Are you continuing to do that? I mean, this is a question for you about your current research and what things you're interested in and writing about. So could you give us an idea maybe about your current projects and things you're interested in?
Are you asking about like next projects?
Okay. Yeah. Are you still going to conferences about permafrost, or are you doing other things?
Am I still going to conferences about permafrost? I haven't. Well, so I joined the U.S. Permafrost Association. And I want to share my work with permafrost scientists if they're interested. I don't know. With COVID, things got a little bit disrupted. I had been thinking about going to the International Conference on Permafrost, but I think it's been postponed. But I think I don't know that I will continue on this very particular topic. I mean, I'm in the process of just doing a lot of exploratory reading for the next project. You know, so two things that I'm reading about these days are like indigenous knowledges and indigenous understandings of the environment, because it was an aspect of the book that I didn't really get into. Wasn't able to get into. The book focuses a lot on, you know, Russian and Soviet scientists and not so much on kind of like indigenous perspectives, even though it features a little bit, because some of the terminology that the Russians picked up were, you know, from like the Saha language and, you know, local languages. So kind of interested in a little bit about kind of indigenous perspectives. But the other, I'm also interested in kind of digging into economic history, looking at how economic history and environmental history interact and how concepts move from one to the other. So, you know, maybe kind of continuing this looking at intellectual history a bit, but expanding to include like economic history. So, yeah, I mean, I think so far I'm just trying to do a lot of exploratory reading. Yeah.
Right. Right. And would you recommend books for our listeners, both here in New Books, Russian and Eurasian Studies, and also in environmental history and sustainability studies? Can you think of others, perhaps two or three authors or books that you might suggest for our listener?
Oh, well, let's see. I can recommend, I think, one that I read somewhat recently, which was, you know, I mean, this book has been getting lots of attention and deservedly so. Bathsheba DeMuth's Floating Coast is you know, a marvelous book. It's about, you know, Russian and Soviet history. It's also about U.S. history, and, you know, we're looking at Beringia, you know, the Bering Strait world, and brings in, you know, indigenous perspectives as well. So, I mean, it's a beautiful book. And then I'm currently reading Maya Peterson's Pipe Dreams, which is about Russian and Soviet water management in Central Asia, and really enjoying that too. It's like very, I'm learning a lot. It's very thorough and scholarly. And then this book that just came out that I'm really looking forward to reading is by Dina Feinberg. It's about Cold War correspondence. It's about like Soviet and American journalists and during the Cold War. And I heard Dr. Feinberg give a presentation on it, and I got interested in, you know, Cold War exchanges in the course of my own work. So I'm looking forward to reading that book too.
Well, I thank you for those suggestions. And you may know that I've had Bathsheba and Maya already here on the podcast for New Books Network. So you're in great company, and those are absolutely marvelous books. I'm also eager to read Dr. Feinberg's book as well. So we are running out of time, and I just wanted to say thank you, Dr. Pei-Yi Chu, for joining us here on the podcast today and talking about your book. And just to mention it again, this is a book out with University of Toronto Press 2021 called The Life of Permafrost, A History of Frozen Earth in Russian and Soviet Science. Congratulations to you, Pei-Yi, again on the publication of your book. And I'm really eager to hear from you again in the next projects that you're working on. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Stephen. It was fun.
And I'm your host, Stephen Siegel, here at the New Books Network. We'll see you next time.